Hello, and welcome to The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm Jeffrey Zeldman, and my guest today is the multi-talented Sarah Parmeter.
Hello, everyone. So nice to be here again. It's been ages.
I know. How are you doing, Sarah?
I'm good. Yeah, it's Friday afternoon for me, so I'm just winding down on work week. I've had a nice, easy day today. Friday
morning for me. And we are recording onto a MacBook Air, so there's always the slight possibility that the show will just abort in the middle because the Air will run out of room.
Really? They're not that bad, are they? Have you not got a new one?
I have a 2 or 3 year old Air, and the reason I'm recording to the Air, I bought, because you know these broadcasts are important to me, so I bought a brand new 27-inch iMac, and I got the Fusion Drive because it said, if you care about performance, you want the Fusion Drive. And then I plugged my Rode Podcaster in and got all this noise and distortion. Because Apple, if you use the Fusion Drive and you plug a remote mic into it, it makes noise. So it defeats the purpose of buying the highest end drive that they make and the highest end Mac that they make and the highest end mic that Rode makes, because you care about the quality. So I bought two of them, one for home and one for work, and they both make the noise. And then I got a USB port, and I thought maybe if I plug the USB in remotely, and that cut it down some, but so I ended up, luckily, because I'm in the web design business, I have a lot of computers around. If I were a consumer, I would just be like, wow, I just gave Apple $3,000 for nothing.
Oh, no. Something that you wouldn't think of, though, in advance, really, I guess, is it?
Well, they don't announce it on their website. I mean, if they said, this drive is much faster and it's great for Photoshop work, but if you use it for any kind of audio, if you care about audio at all, don't buy this because there's a problem with Mavericks and this and our drives, our newest operating system and our newest drives aren't completely compatible because Steve's dead, I guess. They don't put that on their website for some reason. They put down like everyone has a story to tell. buy one of our products and tell the world your story. That's what they
Mine actually has, my screen currently has a great big crack in it. My Retina MacBook Pro. It's I don't know what happened, but apparently I've heard a rumor that sometimes the Apple logo gets pushed in too heavy in manufacturing and it causes a stress break on the screen. So when you shut it and then you put it inside a case, it's just ever so slightly too heavy for the screen that's behind it, and it causes a stress break, and that's exactly where it is. It's on the flip side of where the Apple logo is. So they did tell me, like, come in and we'll replace it for you, but I haven't had time yet, and I can't be doing without it.
Yeah, I called Apple also, and they while not admitting that it was a known problem, even though it's all over Google, they said probably if I brought my 27-inch computers into the Apple store, they would probably replace the drive with a much cheaper drive. He didn't say they'd refund the money, but basically I'd lose the performance. I don't know. So, yeah, and, like, I'd be without a computer for a week. So I'm like, yeah, that's not going to happen. Yeah. So you just work. I think in my next studio I'm just going to put inside an Apple store. There'll just be, like, a little Happy Cog area in a corner. Because that way when something breaks, it'd be like, no problem. They have more.
I mean, it's okay when you have little laptops to carry around and I always feel sorry for the people, because where my Apple store is, it's in a mall. And I always feel sorry for the people that the Apple store's right in the center of the parking lots are either side. And you see these people lugging these iMacs up the escalator.
Yeah, I'm never going to do that. Yeah, I agree. If I buy a lemon, in case anyone from Apple's listening, if you sell me a lemon 27-inch, yeah, I'm just going to like live with it. Because I'm not going into this. I'm not going to be that person. Like,
especially in New York City. I mean, that's some navigating that needs to be done there.
But you know what I could do? I could get my posse to carry it. Like four big gentlemen.
Yeah.
With like, and like a radio. And you just picture that. Just picture that. Come in like something wrong.
Oh gosh, they to be fair, they our Apple Store. They are quite helpful. They did say at one point when they thought that my Retina MacBook Pro was going to have to be in for about 4 days, and I said, "But that is my main machine. That's why I got the decked out $3,500 version of it. That's my main machine." They said, "Oh, well, what you can do is buy a MacBook Air and then bring it back in the meantime. So use that in the meantime, and then bring it back and get a refund for like a no quibble refund."
Really?
Yeah. Because they said that they have to honor the 14-day refund period on any Apple product in the same way that maybe I shouldn't be talking about it, but I've heard a few people who need a Wacom tablet just for one project, and they know that they can get their work done within like 10-day period. So they buy the Wacom tablet from Amazon, use it, and then send it back under the whole no quibble money back guarantee thing.
So if you're an independent filmmaker and you're doing a scene where you need to have like lots of stockbrokers at desks with computers or something, go to the Apple Store, buy like 100 top of the line iMacs, do the shoot all the scenes within the 14 days and bring them back.
Yeah. I'm interested to see how that conversation would go, but apparently, that's what they said was a legitimate thing for me and a friend, actually, who had an iMac go wrong.
Well, I think the listeners have already gotten their money's worth just in those first few minutes of our just with that tip. But you recently, besides designing apps and websites, I'm assuming everyone knows who you are, but maybe that's ridiculous. So Sarah is a designer in the UK, designer, developer, makes iPhone apps, and you recently designed a website for Scottish TV, or a web app for Scottish TV.
Yeah, it's an app, a native iOS app and an Android app. I was working on that for a year for Scottish television. It was a hyperlocal news app. It's kind of an interesting space. A few people have tried to do it. A few big news organizations in the States have tried to do it and failed. So it's an interesting concept.
Hyperlocal.
So almost like the way that they said to me about it was almost the garbage days. You know, I don't know if that's a thing in the States. We have certain days that people come and pick up our trash.
Right.
And they were saying, if that was to change one week, we want to be able to push something that is so local that it's almost contained to just within almost 10, 20 streets almost. But
it's, on the television?
No, on iOS app. So it's a news application, but the news is only relevant to a very small demographic of people.
Now, were you basing it on geolocation, or were you basing it on they put in their permanent address? In other words, something I need to know at home, or would I constantly be getting hyperlocal news as I walked around with my phone?
Well, this was a thing that they brought me in for some of the consulting side of stuff, because they were stuck on that very problem, because they have they ended up going against my advice, actually, and they went for four separate apps. So it was Aberdeen, Glasgow, Edinburgh, and it was one other place. So they basically took the four main cities in Scotland, and they pushed an app that was just for those cities, because they didn't want to deal with having someone who maybe lived in Glasgow but worked somewhere else, and their news.
But what if you do? What if you?
But that's what my quote. That was what I said.
You commute from Glasgow to Aberdeen.
Yeah,
because people do that.
Yeah, they do. They had people within the offices that did that, but they still, for various commercial considerations, they ended up going with four separate apps, which I was vehemently against.
What's the commercial consideration? Are they?
They were pushing, because they're
local hyperlocal ads that go with the hyperlocal news.
Yeah, from physical TV advertising, that they felt that it was almost too hard a sell to get across to people that it would do everything. They wanted to push very specific advertising, and they felt it was easier to do it if they had four separate apps. So they had their own reasoning behind it. But
easiest for them.
Yeah, possibly.
Not for the user.
Very possibly. Because in my eyes, it was going to be a cracking It sounds really bad. I do really like the app, but there's just a few things that it's become a bit of a pain point. That I felt it maybe should have been more geolocation based on certain stuff.
I have found that advertising often wins when you're dealing with publications and broadcasters, because that's their revenue. Because without that, they close their doors. So regardless of, you know, it's supposed to separate church and state, right? News is not supposed to be affected by a sponsor and all that. But to some extent, when they're coming up with new business models, I mean, they have to still think about.
It was a hard project in terms of there was many considerations to it. They had a lot of data that suggested that they had very specific demographics of people at very specific times, which meant that just having content that would maybe hit the mark-ish with people, not entirely, wasn't really going to be commercially viable. It would sink the app immediately because they weren't able to push relevant advertising that was going to make them money at a certain period of the day to hit certain targets. So it was really interesting because it just meant accumulating a ton of data from loads of different sources and sifting my way through it to find what was the common problem within everything and what could solve it. I'm talking about this in my AEA talk this year. So it's all around the whole designing with data stuff is just fascinating. Not designing this, people get confused designing with data. They think of like infographics and stuff like that, not that side of things, but actually physically designing systems and products using data as a massive backup. So
when you remember the story of Douglas Bowman, when he was working at Google, and he quit because they weren't wanted to do it, not A/B testing, I guess there aren't even enough letters in the alphabet. They wanted to test 47 shades of blue. It sounds like a novel. He had picked a color of blue, and for some reason, one of the engineers, I don't know what their problem was, or they said, "Well, what makes you think that shade of blue is correct?" And he said, "Well, I'm a designer. That's kind of what I do." And they said, "Yeah, we need data." So they tested, and they have the resources to do this, like the same design with 47 different shades of blue in that one location to see if there was, I guess, more uptake of whatever was on offer. And so he quit. But when I hear designing with data, that's my fear. Is that what you're talking about when you talk about designing with data?
Not necessarily. I'm not necessarily talking about when it comes down to split A/B testing, because I think at that point you've already made considerations about content, where the content's going to be placed, but it's more how have you come to those decisions about where the stuff's going to be placed in the first place. It feels like we are using our tools, which is HTML and CSS and our design resources. We know how to build this beautiful stuff. It seems like we're not actually sometimes applying knowledge of things that are very easy to gather data on before we start those processes. It's almost like we jump straight in. A lot of people and a lot of projects I've been bought in for have already gone through the design and development phase, and then they're left scratching their head going, "Oh, but actually, we're not sure that it solves the problem of this, that, and the other."
Is it the kind of thing, you remember, you know Luke Rablewski?
I do.
And you know his book, Web Form Design, where he had been design director at Yahoo, and he'd done tests where he just said, "Well, we want people to enter credit card information. What happens if we, you know, left align the information we want them to put in the field? What happens if we top align it? What happens if we right align it?" And they were able to, you know, by running tests, and they were able to determine things like, well, if you want people to slow down a little, set up your form this way, and that might be what you want to do when they're entering credit card information so they don't make a mistake. But if you want people to quickly sign up for an offering, then you maybe want to use a different alignment. Is it more like that kind of information?
Yeah, very similar. There's a few different ways around that I've learned about. Sorry, my dog, you can probably hear in the background, is padding on the wooden floor. There's a few different ways around of using it that I've found that have come up in projects that I've been bought in for. It's either that the design solution that they've come up with isn't working and isn't hitting the mark, because they haven't gathered enough data in the first place. Or it's stuff like that where through the years of being involved in the web design industry, you come to learn these tricks of, oh, if you left align stuff, if you don't have as much information on your page, it doesn't dilute what you're trying to push. Therefore, it gives more prominence to something in the top right-hand corner that you're trying to do. It's
so some of it's things that a designer with experience knows, like, you know, maybe the way to set something off isn't to make it bigger. Maybe it's to put more white space around it.
Yeah.
That kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah, similar stuff to that. It's a whole minefield, really. There's loads of different ways you can use it, but I feel that it's just something at the moment that is not really part of our job description as such. We tend to farm off, especially as freelancers. Maybe in bigger companies, this is something that happens, just a team takes care of it and you get handed a ton of stuff to go through. But even when I've worked within large teams, it's almost like that gets bolted on as the A/B testing phase, rather than let's ask a bunch of questions before we even get into putting pen to paper to do wireframes. Obviously, there's some people who start projects off perfectly like that, and they realize that they have to know certain stuff before they sit down. But I've been surprised by how much money has been plowed into projects for really, really big companies and really like household names. And you walk in and you ask a question and they can't answer it. They yeah. can't tell you stuff. And you're like, this is basic data that you've not gathered.
Do they not have researchers, or do you not work with teams that include researchers?
I don't generally, and I don't know whether that's because they don't put much weight on it or whether it's still something that they're trying to find their feet with, in terms of they don't really know the questions they should be asking, or whether it's one of those things where they go, we don't really know enough about the web to have a researcher who can research it properly. I don't know.
But it's not even about the web, the researcher.
It's
about the people.
But that's what makes me wonder whether they're going, oh, we can't do our research properly because we don't know how to hand it over in a way that a web designer is going to find useful or something.
They're still kind of siloing the web as this mysterious ghetto.
Yeah. I tell you, it's funny. There's I did a load of work for News International, and the data that those guys have on hand is crazy. But that was my job, to sift through it and create systems based on that data for stuff. And that was a fascinating project to be a part of. But they didn't have anyone in-house who could make sense of the data, which to me seemed that's what I get bought in for. And that makes me scratch my head and go, I can't be the only person who can decipher this stuff and create systems.
It's News Inc.?
News Inc., yeah.
That's, what's his name's company?
Oh, News International. Sorry, no, not News Inc. News International, as in who the Sun is owned by. And
right.
Or the bad news organization that leaked a load of data that they shouldn't have done, and gathered data that they shouldn't have done. But yeah, it's I don't know. Maybe I'm not working within.
Are you, when you design with data, are you exposed to like super sensitive data? Are you surprised at what some of these companies know about? Like, is there stuff we should be worrying about?
No, not necessarily, because it's all faceless data. They're very canny in the way that they obscure stuff that if it got out, it would never find its way back to being your specific data.
So it's anonymized.
Yeah, completely, completely. But I mean, how far that goes before it could be hacked, I don't know, because I don't know enough about all of that side of things. But some of the data that I've been exposed to in the past has been that they know your movements, down to what you read on the train, to what you read at the weekends, what section you spend the most time in, and they base personas on that data, which is, to me, all of that's fascinating. I find all of that fascinating.
And of course, Facebook wants you to do all that on Facebook, because then of course they know everything.
Yeah. That stuff's scary though. That's getting scarier, Facebook. I mean, I like it. I haven't been using it as much recently, but some of the stuff that sometimes comes up in my advertising bar, I think, wow, you've preempted that I'm a 30-something-year-old married person, and people of that age are clearly clicking on tons of baby stuff. So
I started getting, I started getting dating site ads when I was still married. I wasn't divorced yet, but you know, my now ex-wife she had moved out. We were separated, and at a certain point on Facebook, she, you know, mine said I was in a relationship, and she said that she was like not in a relationship. And as soon as she changed that, they started showing me ads about like attractive women in New York that wanted to meet me. And I was like, what? And so then, like, and then I, of course, I went to Carrie's page and Facebook and went, oh, I see what happened. But it's like that quick, which is really weird. Like, what if your spouse died? Would they do the same thing? Like, you know, you post that your spouse died of cancer, and then they like start saying hot women are ready to relieve those sorrows. I don't really know. Goodness. I don't know. I mean, cause you know, yeah, I use a style sheet to hide the that stuff now.
Oh, do you?
I shouldn't say that on. I mean, I hate to remove anyone's ability to make a living, but I do. I have a little style sheet that just obscures that one div because I forget what it's like. The div is called something like advertising, and so I just like, you know, wrote a little style sheet that hides that div.
I've never thought to do that, I must admit.
It's one of, and I keep it in Dropbox. And when I get a new computer, it's one of the first things I do. Like, find that in Dropbox and, like, put it, you know, tell my browser that I'm using that. I have a custom style sheet. Like, that's the only thing it does.
Nice.
Hides ads in Facebook. Yeah, so it's weird. And now on my new computers, I've sort of not done it just because I want to see, well, what are they actually doing? Because I should know this, and it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And they're probably doing it anyway, even if I'm hiding it, so I might as well know what they're doing. But I got to say, Facebook is so much prettier if you hide those ads. It's unbelievable.
I bet. The ads aren't even a really good size or anything. Most of them that get pushed in my local area are really ugly as well.
When I was starting HappyCog, when I was freelancing in 1999, like a lot of the work that I got was just like making ad banners for people. You know, and have you ever done that? And you know, you try to like have some kind of interest in aesthetics in that little space, but you really, those aren't necessarily the most interesting clients who are going to go for the most challenging thing you can present. They might think, want to like, you know, make it bigger, make it red, put an outline on the type, make it flash, you know.
I remember doing flash banners. I remember making flash banners as well. Painstaking. I never got my head around that, really.
I think if I'd been better at flash, there might the Web Standards Project might have died. But I once spent like 11 hours with Hellman Curtis's book like propped open, like making letters move. It was like, and I'm sure like Joshua Davis or somebody would have just written an algorithm. I'm sure if I'd been better at scripting, there was probably a way to do it with a script. But instead I was like painstakingly animating each letter. So like that there would be a music to the way that the different letters slid over. And it was, you know, it was a beautiful 1 second of animation that it took me 11 hours. I was like, you know, you see South Park. Do you see South Park in the UK?
No, I don't like it.
Oh, you don't like it?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. I was just going to say they make the show every week. Like they write the concept. They come up with the idea. They write the script and they animate the thing all in a week and deliver it to the station, like physically deliver a film to the station within a week, every week. And they've been doing this for like 17 years or something. It's crazy.
That's pretty impressive.
You don't like it because it's harsh and cruel?
No, I don't know. It was one of those things, I think, in the late 90s or whenever that song came out that dominated the charts. Was that
Blame Canada?
No.
America Fuck Yeah?
No.
That's not
Is
South
it
Park.
Mr. Hankey the Christmas Pooh?
Mr. Hankey the Christmas Pooh. Wait a minute, that dominated the charts?
Here it did.
Oh, because you have a thing in England of Christmas every year where you have a Christmas single?
Yeah.
We don't have that.
Oh, see, that was like number one for about 4 weeks or
Mr.
something.
Mr. Hankey the Christmas Pooh was number one in England?
Maybe it wasn't number one, but it was like number one.
Because it's got to be number two. Sorry. That was just, you teed that up so nicely, I just had
I'm
to.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Set that up.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't know. It's just, I don't actually watch a lot of television.
Really?
At all. I really don't. But I'm really quite sad.
You just did a thing for Scottish television, and you were going to do a television show. What happened with that? Like a web design? Yeah. Are you still going to do that?
Apparently, they're still in the works, but something happened where they sold it to a production company, and now the production company are trying to sell it to a network or something. I don't know. I kind of just went.
What are they selling? The idea? I mean, they haven't shot it yet, right?
No, they've sold the idea of what it is, I think. They're just jumping on the bandwagon of everything geek is suddenly cool. And I think that they've sold the concept, and then the people who have bought the concept are trying to sell it to a network. But that was what I was told, but. You never really know.
So it's a reality show about web design.
Yeah, it sounds thrilling, doesn't it?
I mean, you could bring a reality crew into where I work, and you'd just see people with headphones.
Yeah.
Staring at their screens and sometimes cursing. And then after about 4 hours, they get up and get something else to eat or drink.
Yeah, it's probably going to be the most boring techno. I think the whole thing was meant to be a hackathon type event where everyone was split into teams and designated with making something, and they were going to film the whole thing.
Sure.
And I was one of the judges for it. So I don't know whether that's still the concept or what really, but it did sound pretty cool. It was almost like a full couple of weeks of filming.
So it's like Project Runway, but with websites.
Yeah.
Make it work.
Yeah.
I'm going to dispense with navigation altogether. Make it work.
I haven't watched Project Runway.
You haven't seen Project Runway?
I'm so sad. I don't watch it.
You really don't watch television?
I really don't.
That's not sad. That's great. That means you have a life.
I do watch stuff, but I watch like TED Talks, and I watch Skillshare stuff, and I watch really bizarre things that otherwise people would go, that's really not normal, to get pleasure from watching that sort of stuff over and over. But I do.
What's your favorite TED Talk?
I can't remember the name of it. I should learn it because it comes up so much. But it's one about, I think it's called The Evolution of Language. And it's about a father who, I think he works for MIT University, and he decks out his whole house with cameras. And it captures the evolution of his son learning the word water right from before he can even talk, but he's trying to form the word to say water. And it's just fascinating. It's a really fascinating TED Talk.
Did he put his kid in a Skinner box?
What box?
A Skinner box? You don't know about that?
I don't know what that is.
B.F. Skinner was a behavioral psychologist.
Oh, okay.
Probably in the 1970s, maybe earlier. And he had all these theories about, nurture versus nature. In his mind, most of our behavior was learned, not innate. Most of our personality was learned, not innate. I'm probably doing this wrong, but, I don't claim to be an expert on this. But with Skinner, he actually subjected his own children from the time they were born to tests based around his theories, because he thought, well, here I have these guinea pigs. Here I have these infants, and if I raise them a certain way, then I'll be able to test my theories. And of course, to some extent, every parent does that, but not in a cold science. I mean, every parent, a Christian wants to raise their children to be Christian. And so, an artist wants to raise an artistic child and so on. But, but this is, but not in such a cold, methodical way. So he was kind of a scary guy, I think. He may still be around. B.F. Skinner.
I have to look it up.
He may be contacting his lawyer right now, in fact.
It sounds similar, but what this guy does is he sort of uses these strange cameras. It's not a regular camera, but it captures where it sort of leaves a trail, almost like, like glowworm almost. It leaves a trail of where people are going. You can overlay it on top of the video. So he could tell that the word water was used mostly in the kitchen, in the house. So naturally, I guess, from giving the child water to drink or whatever. So they were able to map where the child was mostly learning certain words and where in the home we use certain words the most, which is where the children learn it, and whether the child was present at the time that the word was being used or not. So it's just like massive data gathering, but it's a really, really good talk.
Designing children with data.
Designing children with data in the kitchen.
Well, that's amazing. I think I've watched one TED Talk.
Oh, really?
That's horrible, isn't it? Like,
I
think TED Talks are great. I love seeing little talks that can inspire you to learn more. And I think they're great. They're great at that.
They are.
I don't know. I'm so busy that when I finally have time to watch television, I kind of want to be purely escapist with it.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense? Also, I have a kid, and I kind of watch what she wants to watch.
Of course, yeah.
Which is mostly like American Dad. I don't know if you've seen that.
No.
No, because you don't watch television. But kind of, she likes kind of raunchy television. Well, I should tell listeners, Sarah Parmenter, among her other achievements, taught my daughter how to swear like a Cockney. You taught her Cockney swear words. She was like five, over like French fries at Penelope Restaurant in New York. You were like, do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
But and you know, with my full complicity, and she was already like really interested in swearing. I mean, it's not like she was saying, let's talk about Jesus, and you said, no, fuck that, here's some swear words. It wasn't like that.
I think it was because didn't you tell me the story of shit, fuck, motherfucker or something?
Yeah, shit, cracker, motherfucker.
That's the one.
Yeah, her mom told her she couldn't swear. She could swear in her room if she was really angry. So one time she got really angry about something. She said, excuse me, mom, went into her room, closed the door, and her mother like listened and heard her saying like, shit, cracker, motherfucker. And then, then she came out again. It was great because, she learned the English words, but then she mistook them, right? So it was like, instead of Fanny, she thought Heine was the word that you had taught her. And like Fanny is an innocent word in the United States. Like people say like to a child, like, did you hurt your Fanny, honey? The kid falls down. But of course, in England, you would never say that. So she got Heine. And so she would like say with a sly grin, like she would say these words that were incorrect with a sly grin, thinking she was being naughty. And, you know, I didn't correct her because it's like, it's great. It's like the best of both worlds.
She's still
being a little kid. But she thinks she's being a badass, but she's actually.
Yeah.
So you recently designed a business, right?
I did.
Outside of all the apps and websites, you just went in this totally other direction. And did you, in fact, use your business today? As you tell listeners that, although the show is audio only, we have video on, and your hair looks like someone blew it out.
Oh, thank you. No, I've just got really good at doing my hair.
Okay. But it's a blowout, right? It's a blowout.
Yeah. It's a blowout bar. So there's tons of them in the States. Sorry, excuse me. I've just always been interested in American concepts that the British haven't quite latched onto yet, because we always end up following the States as much as we like to think that we don't. We always do. And I went to see a talk when I was really young. I paid to go and see a talk of this lady who, I forget her name now, I should really know it, but she went over to the States as a 20-something-year-old, just as the coffee revolution was about to start. And I think she went to one of the first Starbucks restaurants. And restaurants, that always makes me laugh when you think of, it's not a restaurant, is it? But she brought it over to England, and she brought the concept over to England, and she started something called Coffee Republic, which was pretty similar to Starbucks, but because it was the first in England, everyone thought she was crazy, and charging sort of £3 for a cup of coffee when at the time it was drunk out of polystyrene cups and charged sort of 50 cents for or something at the time. So I was really interested in a similar thing. Her talk really inspired me. I was only 21, I think, at the time I heard her talk. And ever since then, I've been looking out for American-based concepts that would work in the UK with a slight twist, because our markets are quite different. And when I was, where was I? I was in New York and I kept seeing blowout bars pop up. And I kept thinking, yeah, it's a good concept, but it works in New York City because it's highly populated. People have events to go to all the time. And then I sort of started looking at it for my local town, a version of not as grand as the ones that you find in the States. Still as beautiful, still as well designed, but not as big a project as those ones are. They have like 14 to 30 staff at any one point.
You bought a building, right?
Yeah.
So you bought a house and you're located in Leon C?
Yep.
Which is about 2 hours from London?
It's 40 minutes from
40
London.
40 minutes from London, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you on the Thames? What are you on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're on the Thames. We're the Thames estuary. That's the on-sea part of it. So yeah, I got a building and renovated it to be a blowout bar. And it seems really a strange thing for a web designer to suddenly...
Yes, and you also found hairstylists, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So local.
So within 3 months, I'd gone from only knowing web and digital to owning a business in a completely different market that I knew nothing about. But I felt confident enough in my design skills that I could have the trust and confidence from the beginning, even though I didn't know what the heck I was doing in terms of the actual hairstyling and stuff. I just rested on my business knowledge, I guess, of if I can find the right people, people who have the right personality, not just who can do really good hair. If I find the right people to work there, and if I employ the best people, then I don't have to worry about the fact that I don't do hair.
How did you attract the people that you wanted to work for you? What did you offer them?
So I did the graphic design of the business first. So I had all the concept artwork. I had concept of interior. We already had the signage up. I did it a slightly backward way in that the signage was up pretty much from the day that I had the keys, which is unusual in England. You wouldn't normally do that. So it had a presence right from the
smart
off, really. And all of the marketing stuff, I did the look. So we have a lookbook of all of the styles that you can have when you come in. I did the art direction and got the photographers to shoot the lookbook prior to getting the keys as well. So all of the stuff looked great and I was able to hook people in on Facebook. So I plowed a ton of money into Facebook advertising for stylists, but using the concept artwork and all of the photos that had been produced as well for the lookbook. So everything looked really slick and unusual for our town. Everyone was sort of saying, oh, what is this? Is it a chain that's moving in? I don't know. It looks really cool. I want to work for them. So
right.
At the time that we went to having interviews, I had 120 applicants for the hairstylist jobs, of which there was only five. So
wow.
I didn't even think that many hairstylists were in this side of the town, to be honest. But I attracted them through the fact that I think they realized that it was going to be something different and it looked great. So the rest was history, really. It was just about looking and finding someone who could come on the day who could assess the hair and make sure that they could actually do hair. So employing someone who was really top-notch at their job to look at them. And I looked at them as people. They looked at them in terms of skills. And we came up with a really great team. So,
wow.
Yeah.
And now you're taking it to another level?
Yeah, now we've had offers of franchise. So there's three people who have come forward, one of who is another girl in our industry, Jeffrey, which I think is fab because she realizes that she too wanted to do something different. She wanted to move in a different direction, but she also wanted to retain using all of her web skills for something that she could oversee and get enjoyment out of. So she's come forward and she's kind of like, I'd really like to do that where I live. Are you interested in franchising it? And another two people who are hairdressers themselves who are interested in franchising. So,
and all of this is in the UK?
Yeah.
And is it all in England or?
One franchise that popped up, someone who wanted to do the franchise was in Ireland, actually. Ireland, Norwich, Cambridge. So It's wow. Exciting. It's really exciting. And
you have a lawyer, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I do. But I try and not use them because they're one of those that you even ask them to open an envelope and you have to remortgage your house.
Yeah.
So.
but when you're setting up a business, it's really, there's a business that I know of where one partner's suing another now, and it's very sad from the outside. And
I know who that is.
And
yeah,
all I can think of is like, every business, no matter, even if it's just started as a conversation, you still sit with a lawyer and write something up. You have to. Mm-hmm. And even though it seems weird, you have to, because.
Yeah. Yes. They're worth their money. It just drives
totally.
Me crazy.
Totally. A good lawyer is amazing.
It just drives me crazy, the language that they use, because you just think, just simplify it so I can read it without reading it a million times. But I understand why they do that as well. So.
Do you think it's a foreign language? Do you think that they do that the way like bad web designers throw like HTML language around to mystify the customer and make them think, wow, I better pay them a lot of money. They really know what they're talking about. They're using PHP. Wow. I'm not That's careful. Exactly. Yeah.
That's exactly what I think it is. Yeah. I think they just close in on their own ranks. They know that we don't understand it. So
it's the history of the way legal systems evolved and maybe they all studied logic. You know, maybe it's all from Plato and Aristotle. I don't know. But it is very, I'm actually a great client for lawyers and stuff, because I just go like, I just ask them to explain in English, and then I go, yeah, that's not, whatever they, I always go with what they recommend.
Yeah.
I've disregarded legal recommendations only a couple of times, and I always ended up regretting it because.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because, yeah.
Yeah. They are worth their money. They are worth their money. But yeah. So that's.
Well, my first marriage was a kind of a mistake, and I realized it like a few months in. And when I actually went to tentatively talk to a lawyer, she said, tear up your credit cards and close your bank accounts immediately. And I was like, well, I really just know I wouldn't never do that. And, you know, my wife and I have a trust-based relationship and we're friends and I think we'll figure this out and it's going to be fine. And of course, like, it was I should have done those things, because as soon as I told her, I'm unhappy enough that I've talked to a lawyer, but I don't want you to panic. And I here's what's going on. I was basically, my credit card was being used to buy houses and missile launchers. And she bought lingerie and had it shipped to a friend's house in Brooklyn on my company credit card, so that my company would think that I was keeping a mistress and using company money to pay for my mistress, so that the company then fired me, which is what she wanted. She wanted, so like, she cost me my job because I didn't listen to a lawyer.
Oh no.
Yeah. So I try to listen to them now.
That is another level of conniving though.
Well, don't fuck with an Argentine is basically what I learned.
Okay.
She was an Argentine lady, an actress. Really, really talented and very passionate. And I became her enemy, although I didn't really want to. I wanted to be like, just a fuck up. I just wanted to be like, I'm so sorry. I didn't know what I was doing. I'm a dummy. How can I help you? This is a mistake. Like a lot of relationships. It was sort of like, you know how you can get into a relationship and after like 2 months, you realize it's a mistake?
Yeah.
Except we'd gotten married. We got married right away because it seemed romantic. It seemed romantic, like to marry someone you don't know.
Yeah, I can
see. Have you ever had that feeling? Like I was drunk.
No.
I was drunk and it was like, this would be the most romantic thing. This is totally going to work. We'll be that like love story of the two people who met, didn't really know each other, got married and, you know, or were together for 100 years. But actually,
it's 2 months.
No, it was.
I admire the spontaneity of that. I'm not spontaneous as that, you see.
I'm a lot less spontaneous now. But what are you about? You're not as spontaneous now? You're like...
No, I've never been spontaneous like that. I would be, even when drunk, I'm actually a really sensible drunk.
Really?
I am, yeah. Well, you've seen me drunk. I'm all right.
I have.
I'm okay. I'm quite dignified.
Well.
Yeah, I am.
You are. You're dignified.
Only maybe when Christina Halverson's involved am I not, and then things get a little crazy. But I'm a dignified drunk.
I was a nice drunk.
Yeah, see, I loved everybody. Best.
I loved everybody. I still do. I actually do love everybody. It's just that when you're drunk, it's sloppy. I gotta tell you, I feel exactly like you're my brother. You're my brother. Even though you're a woman, I know, but you're my brother. I mean, you know, like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what are your plans for the franchise? Are you just going to step away from running the thing? Or are you just going to how are you going to do it?
No, the plan is I'm quite finicky with it, actually. I'm quite finicky about the people we employ, the brand being retained, the high standards and stuff like that. So I've had to have awkward conversations about that and say, please don't think that I'm just going to hand you a package of how to run this with a blueprint of how to build this, with a blueprint of exactly what web services we use to run the thing.
Someday you will. 5-10 years from now, you will.
Yeah.
Five, ten years from now, you'll have to do something like that. But you have to establish, the first few stores have to be perfect.
They really do, because I've read a story about a company in the States who are really big now. They have tons of dry bars in New York, and they did a similar thing. They franchised early in order to give more cash flow to the fledgling business, and then the two franchise stores bought down the overall standard, and then they had to buy the franchise stores back in order to get the quality back up to where it was, because they weren't happy about the way they were being run. So it was, I've read about that, and I've got that horror story in the back of my head. But
there's some gyms like that here in New York. They're franchised. Like every time there's a nice gym that starts to, that's really beautiful and new and people are using it, one of these two companies moves in and basically buys it. And the owner gets money, so the owner's happy. And it just turns to shit because they don't really care. They're about numbers. It's about getting as many people to sign up as they can. And they have like all these really loud classes all the time. So
yeah,
it works for them as a business. And people, people are price sensitive. So if the gym is a little cheaper and has all the equipment, they're going to be fine.
Mm. It's funny, in England, people are price sensitive, but for this type of service, because it's seen as a luxury and not a necessity.
Totally a luxury. It's totally a luxury. I can't think of anything more luxurious, seriously, than like you already cut your hair, you already washed your hair, you styled it when you got out, when you left the house this morning, and now you're going to have someone just brush it again. And that's, what is that, like 40 quid? I don't know.
We do, so wash, blow dry, and style, 22.
That's good. Mm. That's about $30 US?
Yeah, so it's on target with the same as the US one. So
it's less than New York. I think New York is like 40.
New York's 40.
I walk by them all the time.
Yeah, New York.
I look in hungrily because it's like filled with beautiful women who are just like, I have 20 minutes to make myself even more attractive. It's like okay, I don't mean I stare in hungrily, but I mean I said that already, so I can't really get out of it now. Okay. Anyway.
In terms of
Look, we're out of time.
Oh, are we?
No,
oh, okay. I thought you were going along those lines. Yeah. In terms of a business model, it seems like a strange thing to suddenly go into, but my whole ethos behind it was, what's the worst that can happen? You're drying wet hair. You're not having to put chemicals on it. You're not having to do anything. So in terms of a barrier to entry in any business, it's probably the lowest. You don't need to really hold stock. You need shampoo, water, and a hairdryer.
Wow. Yeah. So like the equivalent would be skinning WordPress sites. Not building them. Skinning them. because they're like, what's the worst that can happen? They don't like the color and I change it.
Yeah. It's a very simple business model, which is why I chose it.
It's smart. You're not spontaneous. You are very logical about
how I'm extremely this. Logical. Yeah. Painful.
That doesn't usually go with design.
No. No, but
you it seem, I mean, when you design, it seems very instinctual and, you know, aesthetic. You just have an aesthetic sense and you just please your aesthetic sense, it seems.
But this is where I've now changed, because now I don't do anything before I can have a really good read of the company as a whole and what problems they're facing, and not just problems with their website, but problems as a company as a whole. And now I feel like, since the whole flat design, inverted commas, I hate that term, mm-hmm. has come in, I feel like designers' jobs just got a whole ton easier. Whereas before, I remember doing stuff in Photoshop for hours, creating these beautiful things, slicing them up and fixed width and all of this stuff.
Well, they got easier and harder, though.
It got easier because design.
Well, to make it effective and good, you have to really know what you're doing and really be good. It's kind of easy to hide behind lots of textures. I mean, it takes a lot of work in Photoshop to make like all those drop shadows and textures and all patterns and all that stuff. But it also, you could be like an average designer and make something look really pretty and shiny. But if you don't have any of those tools, it's almost like if you, you know, it's like going to a theater and there's just an actress on the stage, no set, you know, no songs, no dances. And then that actress has to be great to make that work and to make the audience suspend their disbelief. She's got a chair, no props, no sets. She's got to totally suspend the audience's disbelief by the power of her acting ability. When iOS 7 came out, I was like, the things that worked were beautiful, but the things that, like the calendar, was like, wow, you have to be a real master of type to make this calendar work without all the parts of a that we associate with a calendar. Yeah. And whoever built that part, it's not working for me. I'm confused. I'm looking around going, which part of this is the field where I enter data about the event? And I ended up switching to fantastical because and I've actually had those folks on the show, but I can't use the iCal calendar anymore because it's not good flat design. But anyway, you're right. It's removed a lot of the tasks. You don't have to spend hours like doing gradients.
Yeah. And I think in terms of like if you're talking to a college student about what they feel, if they were thinking they wanted to go into design for the web, they would be looking at the aesthetic side of designing for the web and they would go, oh, well, it just got a ton easier because now I just have to put a flat color in on a bar and put a bit of navigation on it. And I don't have to worry about any of the aesthetic stuff that once upon a time we would all obsess over things.
But before designers got involved, real early, when there were not many designers on the web, there were a lot of sites that were designed by developers and they basically used type and color and it was flat design and it looked like shit.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be a really good designer to just use type.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think it's, some of my favorite sites are those that are laid out properly with good typographical hierarchy and stuff like that. Like I think Jessica Hish's site is brilliant for that. I think she nails it.
John Tan's site, although he hasn't updated it in years.
Yeah, all of those people but they know their stuff about typography.
Right.
Obviously. The whole design movement at the moment, which is I guess why I am quite logical with stuff now, because I've realized that it's not enough just being able to design something. Whereas once upon a time I was quite naive and I was like, I can make anything look pretty.
Right.
I think everyone went through that stage as a designer. You go through that really naive stage of, well, that's a really ugly website. I know I can do a better job than that.
Right.
And then you grow up a bit and you go, okay, actually there's considerations behind this and there's stuff that needs to be thought about. And I think that even now, I've been likening it to when we would use the lorem ipsum text. We know it's bad. I still do that for my own stuff, even though I know it's bad. We still have these like bad practices that come in that when we think no one's looking, we sometimes sneak it in and do it. But with the whole designing with data thing, I don't skip that at all. And I found that my designs are better for it. And even if it's just the tiniest thing, and with my side project, I can just gather what you would think would be insignificant nothingness on the way that people use our website or the way that people book appointments online. I'll change one thing and see the appointment books go up, see a direct correlation between it. And that stuff fascinates me.
Well, now you're also talking about the joy of doing your own site, doing your own web-based business or news or contents or whatever it is that you're always tinkering with and always improving. I love that, like, after delivery, like, just making little changes. That's, to me, that's the best part of it. And when you're a consultant, you don't usually get to do that. The client will change it because they have to, but you're not usually... Yeah. One thing that... one idea I love that we're trying to do more of in our design business for clients is work into the schedule that we will come back at a certain time and look at how you've been using it and what you can do and either design or make suggestions or evaluate, you know, because it's really about how are people using it and how are the people who, for whom it was built using it, right? Right.
Yeah.
You know, how is the client using it? Not only the user, but the user who's the client.
Yeah.
Because we took a guess and now that they're actually using it, now we have data about it and we can rethink it.
Yeah. I think data has become one of those really scary things that we just apply the label thinking that you have to almost be a consultant level in order to do anything about it or look for it yourself. It seems like some of the teams I've worked with are waiting for someone else to gather the data for them. But actually, if they just dug for an hour or so into some files, they'd be able to find that themselves. But they've become so scared of this whole, you need to be a proper UX consultant who knows what they're doing and knows what to do with it. People don't do it. It's a massively skipped stage in the projects that I've certainly been brought in for. And I know that Aaron Walter just wrote a really good post on A List Apart about how they're now using that within MailChimp and using it to inform designs. And they've basically said to people, don't worry that you feel that you don't have the knowledge or anything to use this data. Input what you find and let's correlate it across the company and let's make it really easy for everyone to have access to this, not just managers, not just, we want you to have access to this because we want you to use it to inform decisions about any design-led process. And that's what I think is going to be the key going forward, and that's what I'm writing my talk about.
I can't wait to see it, and I hope you'll also write about it later on. And we are now out of time, but this has been absolutely wonderful, as always. Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah Parmenter. Where can people find you? You're Sazzy on the web.
Sazzy on the web everywhere, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, listeners, and we'll be back with another Big Web Show.